Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether Syria will be Iran's Vietnam as Tehran's support for the Assad regime deepens in a civil war that could become a quagmire for the axis of resistance. Beirut-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis joins us, the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. He has a forthcoming article at Foreign Policy, Syria, Iran's Vietnam, How the Civil War in Syria is a Quagmire for the Axis of Resistance. Then we'll examine the possibility that the upcoming peace talks Secretary of State Kerry brokered with the Russians might end the bloody standoff in Syria that has cost over 80,000 lives and destroyed much of the country. Investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus, the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, joins us to discuss his article at The Nation, The First Good News for Syria. Then finally, we'll assess the likely outcome of Saturday's elections in Pakistan, where the charismatic leader of the new PTI party, Imran Khan, fell 15 feet from a crane at a rally and is recuperating in hospital. Samir Dosani joins us to discuss Imran Khan's anti-corruption campaign and how it might affect his chances of joining a coalition government headed by one of the two major parties that are mired in corruption. Joining us now is Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who is a fellow at the Century Foundation, writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe, and blogs at thanasiskambanis.com. He is the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his forthcoming book is about Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. His forthcoming article at Foreign Policy is Syria, Iran's Vietnam, How the Civil War in Syria is a Quagmire for the Axis of Resistance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
Always great to talk to you, Ian.
And I must say, your article that's coming out soon in Foreign Policy is a real eye-opener, and it recalls a very cynical statement that Henry Kissinger made during the Iran-Iraq war that, as you know, went on for 8 years and cost both Iran and Iraq enormous lives and treasure. Henry Kissinger was purported to have said about that war, it's a pity both sides can't lose. And I take it that you think that the U.S. strategy vis-a-vis Syria now is very similar, that the U.S. is pretending to be concerned but is actually allowing the bloodletting to continue because, in a sense, they want both sides to lose.
Yeah, it's a grim strategy if in fact this is what they're doing, and I think it's got a lot of potential pitfalls. But the basic storyline goes like this: the more all these parties involved in Syria tear each other apart, the stronger and better off America is relative to everybody else. And it's a when you think about the idea of Syria as a failed state. Jihadis and fighting in parts of it, a regime clinging to life in another, supported by Iran and Hezbollah, Turkey and Qatar propping up rebels on the other side. It sounds horrible, and it is horrible, and the human cost is enormous. And the strategic calculus, though, might be quite simply that all these horrors in Syria aren't really going to do that much harm to core national interests elsewhere in the region. So the worse it gets in Syria, the worse it is for Syrians. But that's all it is. And that applies. I'm not espousing this line of thinking. I'm just analyzing that. I think that might be what's motivating the U.S. government here. And if this is what they're thinking, even something as horrifying morally as the use of chemical weapons doesn't really change that. I mean, that's not gonna change the course of the war. It's just gonna mean that some of the people who are dying horribly are gonna die in a still more horrible way.
So what do you make then of the recent visit to Moscow by Secretary of State Kerry? And apparently they are going to resurrect this dead letter peace proposal of nearly a year ago and have a conference later in a few weeks, I take it. But it's very, very uncertain whether Moscow can lean on Assad to talk to opposition fighters, who he calls terrorists. And it's equally doubtful that Washington can also bring the rebels to the table, because they blame Assad, quite rightly, for killing 70,000 Syrian. So, and my understanding is that for both the rebels and Assad, this is an existential struggle. So is the trip to Moscow further window dressing, or is Kerry and by extension Obama really trying to end this?
Well, the idea of a political settlement is, as you said, a sort of non-starter right now. And the truth is, you know, neither the United States nor Russia have any real skin in this game. I mean, this war could go on for years more with another 70,000 dead or more without really changing anything for Washington or Moscow. So for these two superpowers, which you know arguably have the potential to get involved in a way that ends this, a waiting game is just fine. So what they've done with the political settlement idea is they've just kept it on the table. And it only becomes relevant if something real and major changes on the ground. So, for example, let's imagine that that the rebels do well enough to overrun the capital, and the regime finally says, members of the regime finally say, okay, we're willing to jettison Bashar al-Assad and maintain our own survival. Then they would grab this lifeline that's been sitting there the whole time in the guise of this very unsatisfactory political settlement. You know, similarly, what if, you know, some reverse scenario happens in which the rebels get pushed back out of territory that they've liberated for over the past year, and suddenly the idea of a negotiated settlement starts to look better. In my view, that's the only, those are the only scenarios in which a negotiated transfer becomes likely. But we have to remember, unfortunately, this regime has a lot of gas. It's got a lot of it's got a lot of capacity to hang on, and that is that's why this war has gone on as long as it has, and that's why Washington and Moscow and Tehran also are able to say with a straight face, "Hey, we've got to have a political settlement to this." And the reason why they can say that is because there is nobody looks likely to win by force.
Again, I'm speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is the author of A Privilege to Die: Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. His forthcoming article at Foreign Policy is Syria, Iran's Vietnam, How the Civil War in Syria is a Quagmire for the Axis of Resistance. So clearly, Hezbollah is deeply involved in the Syrian battle, and the rebels consider them, both the Iranians and Hezbollah, are the same as the Assad people because they're being shot at by them. And they refer to Hezbollah as Shiite dogs, or playing on the name of the Party of God, they call them the Party of the Devil. The recent Israeli strikes, my understanding, actually targeted Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps people. They killed quite a number of them. Is that your understanding?
I mean, I only have secondhand reports about those strikes, and so I'd been hearing that they were Iranian weapons being destined for Hezbollah. I hadn't heard that there were IRGC members killed in those strikes, but you know that would be completely within reason because it is the Revolutionary Guard that supervises the transfer of those weapons to Hezbollah, and it's been a tight operational sort of team between Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah on the ground for the better part of a decade, with sort of Damascus being the sort of physical bridge between Tehran and the rest of the Arab world, and that is a team that is under threat by the uprising in Syria, and which Iran and Hezbollah have really gone in all in to try and protect this regime, which was not inevitable. I mean, a year ago they could have hedged their bets and even found a way maybe to support parts of the uprising so that they would have an ally in Syria no matter who won the war, and instead what they chose to do is put all their money, so to speak, on Assad, and that is why they're in the situation they're in today, where Iran is more or less propping up the regime and the state, and Hezbollah is propping up the military side of the war.
And as your book, The Nasi Kambanis, about Hezbollah, A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, as it pointed out, that it was Hezbollah's resistance to Israel in 2006 that gave it tremendous kudos in the Arab world and by extension helped Iran's image in the Arab world, which is odd given that it's a Shiite country and the predominant sect of Islam in the Arab world is Sunni. But you're arguing now that they've squandered all of this enormous investment that they've made in goodwill and all the reconstruction that they did after the 2006 war. That's changed. Now, you're based in Lebanon. What is the sense on the ground there in terms of how Hezbollah can explain that this army that stands up to Israel is propping up a murderous dictator in Syria?
Yeah, let me say clearly. I don't think I've said that they've squandered all of it. I think what they have lost is their sort of ideological appeal across sectarian lines. So I think they've squandered an important piece of their reputation. I'm not sure yet how important that is to their survival as a powerful armed group and as a spoiler. So essentially, 7 years ago, Nasrallah was the most popular person in the Arab world, and Hezbollah had this sterling reputation among Shia, but also Sunni Muslims, Christians, Druze, and others. Today, you'd be hard-pressed to find any Sunni Muslims anywhere in the Arab world who have a nice thing to say about Hezbollah, but that hasn't yet done a thing to weaken them as a military power. Now, the question you ask is the key question, right? Which is, will this sort of, from our vantage point, this sort of cynical Machiavellian union between Hezbollah, the resistance movement, and Bashar Assad, the status quo tyrant, will it eventually lead to Hezbollah's downfall or to Hezbollah's downgrading from the position it earned for itself? And I'm of two minds of that. I mean, on the one hand, I think it's impossible in the long run for Hezbollah to present itself as the pure-hearted herald of resistance against Israel when it's sending apparently thousands of its own fighters to kill fellow Islamist Arabs who are essentially fighting for the right to have a voice in their own government. So I think that hurts them. On the other hand, this idea, which might seem crazy to us, really does fly in a lot of parts of the region. And the idea is that Syria, along with Iran, have been the two states that have consistently sponsored groups that fight Israel. So when you look at Hamas or Islamic Jihad or Hezbollah or any of these groups that have consistently attacked Israel, their support financially, militarily, politically, always goes back through Damascus and Tehran. And so Nasrallah, in his speeches, always argues this. Without Syria, there is no resistance. Without Syria and Tehran, there is no fight against Israel. And if you believe that, then defending this regime in Damascus takes on a different hue than it does, certainly, I think, to us or to folks who are involved in this mass uprising. And that's what he's gambling on. And I just have to remind myself that historically, in other times, like right after the 2006 war, when Hezbollah seemed on its last legs, they've rebounded politically stronger than ever. So I think it wouldn't be wise to write them off just because their current position seems hypocritical and untenable and unsustainable. They've found their way out of straits like that before.
But they've already lost Hamas, which have moved out of Damascus, and I think have largely broken their ties with Tehran. And in spite of the efforts on the part of Ahmadinejad, who visited Egypt to reach out to the new Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt, it's pretty clear that Morsi and company are very unhappy about Iran's position vis-a-vis Syria and are quite opposed to it. I mean, the people fighting against Assad are the Muslim Brotherhood. So that's the Turkish.
I think that's right, and I think that makes the alliance between Hezbollah and Tehran and Bashar al-Assad all the more, it cements that alliance all the more tightly. The more that this so-called axis of resistance is either viewed as a pariah or viewed as a spoiler by the new post-uprising Arab governments, the more these Tehran, Damascus, Hezbollah axis has an incentive to stick together and go down fighting. And I think the other thing we have to remember is there's a possible scenario, a very sad one, in which Syria effectively splits in two, where neither the regime can't crush the uprising and the uprising can't take over the country, and what we would end up with there is a Syria that's as fragmented as Lebanon is today, and in which half of Syria is controlled by some rump Assad regime that works very closely with Tehran and with Hezbollah to continue to do a lot of what it's done today, with even less of the accountability that used to come with Syria, at least trying to be a member of the community of nation states. I mean, imagine the Assad regime without a UN seat, without the full trappings of a state, sort of freed from the obligations to even sort of pretend to subscribe to international norms, and yet, possessing an army and loyal soldiers and this, sort of limitless checkbook from its alliance with Tehran. That is a pretty the sort of toxic recipe, and at that point, they could happily try and undermine the new Arab governments like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, as well as the old Arab governments like the King of Jordan and the King of Saudi Arabia, as they already have been doing.
Well, but in the broader picture, though, it would seem, Thanasi Kambanis, that first of all, already the civil war in Syria is affecting the Sunni uprising in Iraq, and Maliki, for all intents and purposes, is the mayor of Baghdad. Obviously, he's in the Iranian axis, but that situation is extremely tenuous and is likely to get worse. The plan B that the Assads appear to have with the ethnic cleansing that's going on in the northwest in the traditional mountain home of the Alawites, that does look as if they're preparing for a petition there. But that would be kind of an isolated pocket, would it not? It'd be like what Gaza is to Hamas, vis-a-vis the PLO. Wouldn't the Sunni, the Brotherhood would basically have them cut off, wouldn't they? They'd go from Turkey.
Again, I don't want to end up sort of, I don't think that this is a great idea, obviously. And I'm not sure how sustainable it would be, but what they have clearly tried to set out is a sort of Alawite homeland that would go from Damascus all the way to the sea. And if they managed to carve that out and hang on to it, it would actually be quite sustainable, because you'd have this whole area, a lot of the most populated area of Syria, including the coastal areas where the Russian naval base is, and the Alawite-controlled mountains connecting them. So that, if they got that, and if they had the support of Russia and Iran, the continuing support from those two states, I think it would be quite hard for the Muslim Brotherhood or the FSA or Nusra Front or anyone to dislodge them. And that is why that's such an alarming prospect, because if they went that route, it would require a humongous kind of military effort to clean them out of the Alawite mountains, so they'd either have to come to some political settlement or they'd be able to hang on to that. And I think, I mean, you've talked about this a bit in our conversation today, and I think it's an important part of it. There's been a real maximalist rhetoric, sectarian rhetoric from the government, and increasingly from the uprising, and it's really polarized this conflict and turned it into not just a national uprising against the dictator, but into this very unfortunate, epochal sort of sectarian fight between Sunnis on one side and Shia and their allies, or Shia and their minority Christian and other allies on the other side. And even if that's a false narrative, increasingly a lot of people fighting in this war see it that way, and that becomes much, much harder to reconcile, because if you're a Christian in Damascus and you feel like your personal and group survival is on the line, you're going to look at this war a different way than if you look at it as the contest between two different forms of organizing your government. And that's been, I think, one of the saddest parts of this conflict.
But just in closing, Thanasi Kambanis, the point is that both Iran and Hezbollah are doubling down. And we may be vacillating either because we're not sure of who to support and how to support the rebels, or we may be very cynical in having this situation bleed Iran and turning it into Iran's Vietnam. Obviously, Iran's propping up this collapsing state, as you point out, and Hezbollah is propping up the collapsing military situation for Assad, who can't rely on the Sunni and his army. So just in closing, I guess the most reasonable prediction would be that this will just go on for a long time. And if that's the case, then your thesis is going to be proven correct. It really is going to weaken Iran.
Yeah, I mean, I hope I'm wrong, and I hope some change in either the external intervention profile or in the luck of the rebels on the ground. I hope something changes so that we get a resolution to this conflict in the next year and we don't see the death toll going into the six digits and up, into the hundreds of thousands and up. But I'm very afraid that, you know, past performance being the best predictor of future performance, that what we're going to see is an increasingly deadly stalemate, and one in which all the outside players have an interest in extending it, and in which the involvement of groups like Hezbollah and Iran full tilt on one side makes it all the more intractable. And, you know, unfortunately, I think the best bet now is for, you know, 2 to 5 year civil war from now before we get any kind of resolution at all.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation, writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and blogs at thanasikambanis.com. He's the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his forthcoming book is about Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. His forthcoming article at Foreign Policy is Syria, Iran's Vietnam Question: How the Civil War in Syria is a Quagmire for the Axis of Resistance. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether there's a possible ending to the war in Syria in the works. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Dreyfuss, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, Iran, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. Robert Dreyfuss was profiled as a leading investigative journalist by the Columbia Journalism Review, won 2 awards from the Washington Monthly, and was awarded Project Censored's first prize for a story on the role of oil in U.S. policy towards Iraq. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, and he has an article at The Nation, The First Good News for Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Dreyfuss.
Oh, thanks. It's my pleasure.
And the meeting that took place a couple of days ago in Moscow with Secretary of State Kerry, who met with President Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, they seem to have been able to revive a peace conference based on the 2012 joint resolution issued by the United States, Russia, and others. This moribund plan has been welcomed by the beleaguered United Nations representative on Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi. And I take it, Robert, you think this is good news.
Well, it's definitely good news. It's interesting that for the past number of months, whereas we can certainly be critical of some of the things that Obama has done on Syria, he's resisted and continues to resist a lot of pressure to get much more deeply involved, let's say by arming the rebels or instituting a no-fly zone or bombing Syria or other actions that have been suggested. He resisted a plan that was put forward inside the administration by Hillary Clinton and General Dempsey and David Petraeus and some others last fall, and he's continued to resist that even up to today, even after the Israeli bombing of Damascus over the weekend. And instead, he's held back from the pressure over this supposed red line on the use of chemical weapons and said, well, we just don't know enough. Let's wait and see what we learn. And then he sent Kerry off to Moscow to see if there could be some sort of U.S.-Russian accord that would get the warring parties to the bargaining table. So, of course, that's really good news, and it's unclear whether, you know, it would succeed or not, but it's a lot better than getting more deeply enmeshed in another war.
Well, of course, the hurdle is monumental in as much as the Alawites and the regime of Assad see this war as existential. It's their survival at stake. And the Sunni, who are being murdered wholesale by the Assad regime, see it also in the same way. And it's, so it's highly unlikely that Assad will sit down with a group that he considers terrorists, and it's equally unlikely that the rebels will sit down with the butcher of 80,000, maybe 100,000 of their people.
Well, I don't agree with using words like butcher and slaughtering and murder and all of that stuff. This is not really, although it's becoming more and more every day, it's not really some sort of religious jihad war. This is a war between a government which is quite secular, by the way, which is, though it may be dominated by many Alawites, they've worked quite happily, and many of the top officials have been Sunnis, including generals and others, all along, just the way Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq was not sectarian but secular. And so the Syrians, you know, the government has lots of people in it and around it that could work with people on the other side who are less sectarian, less al-Qaeda-oriented, less religious fundamentalist, and who are more moderate. The problem is that the more the fighting has gone on, and it's been 2 years now, it's become increasingly polarized. So it's about time that the United States and the Russians step in and try to depolarize this war. Is it too far along? I don't know. I really don't know. But it doesn't help to, you know, use words like you just did about, you know, butchering this and that. There's a lot of butchering on both sides.
Yeah, but Robert,
the United States' job now is to try to reduce the hatred and the bitterness and try to prevent it from becoming an all-out Shiite versus Sunni conflict.
Well, Robert, I'm not using those words as a pejorative description of my own. I'm using those words to indicate that that is how the rebels feel about the regime.
Well, that's how some rebels feel about some people in the regime. But there are lots of people inside Syria who are not so extreme that they will refuse utterly to talk to Assad. In fact, even the leader of the Syrian opposition at one point said, sure, I'll sit down and talk to members of Assad's government. And he came under some fire for that a while back, but he has expressed a willingness to do so. There have been some intermediaries involved, including one intermediary who was a very high-ranking Syrian official who's very close to Maher Assad, the president's brother, who apparently did have some discussions with some members of the opposition. So there are people on both sides willing to talk, and that's what happens in war. People are killed in large numbers in wars, and then eventually somebody sits down and has a peace conference. And, you know, that's what we ought to be doing with the Taliban. That's what ought to be happening in other conflicts. And in Syria, because Assad is so dependent on outside support, and because the rebels in turn are so dependent on their outside support, it's possible that the outside powers, not just Russia and the United States, but Saudi Arabia and Turkey and others, can exercise a lot of leverage. Of course, the wild card is Iran, which supports Assad very strongly, and I would imagine that they would have to be brought into this arrangement in some way as well, but that may be really the biggest hurdle in trying to get this done.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Dreyfus, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, Iran, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He has an article at The Nation, The First Good News for Syria. Now, preceding you on the program today, Robert, was Thanasi Kambanis, who's written extensively about Hezbollah and lives in Beirut and has been covering Hezbollah's role and Iran's role in the Syrian conflict. And he had put forth a thesis which is pretty cynical, but it reminds me of what happened in the Iran-Iraq war, where Henry Kissinger once said, it's a pity both sides can't lose, that perhaps an explanation for apparently the U.S.'s sort of vacillating over what to do could be explained in the idea that they're perfectly happy, and so are the Israelis, to have this bloodletting go on for years. It weakens both their enemies.
No, I think that's a ridiculous point of view. I think that Obama is genuinely, you know, in a quandary about what to do. The mistake that he made early on, now I'm going back 2 years when this trouble first started, was far too early in the process he called for Assad to step down. And that's because I think the United States was so caught up then in the spirit of the so-called Arab Spring that we thought, well, every time there's a, you know, a disturbance in an Arab country, there'll be a lot of hubbub, and then the leader will quit. And if you remember, we managed to kind of force out the head of Yemen at that point, and Mubarak had fallen, and the Tunisian leader Ben Ali had fallen, and there were others, you know, who were teetering. And so it was like, well, okay, let's just say that Assad has to go. But what that did, in fact, was take a fight that had been somewhat contained, and it meant that a lot of people, including the Saudis, who could jump in and say, well, we don't like Assad much. You know, he's this radical secular guy with, you know, tendencies that we don't appreciate. So they started backing a lot of these right-wing Muslim extremists, and the fight took off big time starting in the summer and fall of 2011 and has expanded since then. So you know, we had a hand in kind of putting accelerant onto the flames there because we thought Assad would be kind of a pushover. And in fact, you know, he's held on, and some people are even arguing that the Syrian forces themselves are beginning to make gains in places, taking back territory from rebel-held areas and other kinds of things. So he's held on far, far longer than the Obama administration thought. If you go back to last year, you'll see statements from Obama and from Secretary Clinton and others saying, well, it's only a matter of time, you know, weeks or months before Assad collapses. Well, of course, no, he didn't collapse. And so I think now, you know, Obama has few good options. It's difficult for us to get involved in supporting these rebels because many of them are in fact, al-Qaeda-linked, and it's hard to tell one from the other. And it's very difficult, if not impossible, for us to open up dialogue with Assad at this point. So that's where the Russians come in. And I think, you know, Obama would genuinely like some sort of agreement to make this all go away now, whatever happens. It isn't like Syria is, you know, some vital American interest that what government turns out to be, you know, the government in Damascus is going to affect America in some grand way. It's not. It's a tiny country that whoever runs it, you know, we don't really care. But I don't think Obama wants this to become a regional war, and that's what could happen. It could be spread into Lebanon. It could spread into Iraq. Iran could get involved. Certainly get spread into Jordan, and even the Israelis, as we've seen, could get involved. So this is the last thing we want, for Syria to become the trigger for some kind of regional explosion.
Well, I understand, Robert Dreyfus, that one of the things that influenced you, the U.S.'s optimism in those early days with Hillary Clinton saying it was a matter of time before he falls, before Assad falls, that was coming from the Turks, their government being Muslim Brotherhood, in alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, were prematurely euphoric, I guess would be a way to describe it. Just in closing, though, let's talk a little bit about pushback here in the United States against Obama's efforts to end this war and work with the Russians, which appears to be the case here. You've got Elliot Abrahams and others, the neocons, in a lather over this. You've also got John McCain, who obviously has been a hawk all along, and he's made derisive remarks about if the Israelis can fly over Syria, why can't the U.S. have a no-fly zone? Of course, militarily, what he's saying is preposterous and irresponsible, because it's a whole different matter to make an airstrike as opposed to have a round-the-clock umbrella over a country. So just in closing, what's your sense then of how much the pushback's going to affect this possible peace deal and conference that Russia and the U.S. are organizing?
Yeah, I don't think that the yapping of the neocons will affect what Obama does in the slightest. I don't think that they have any real influence in the administration, and he can safely ignore them. Their narrative is completely different. They want an all-out worldwide war on Islamic radicalism. As you know, they called it World War IV or something back in the Bush administration days. I guess World War III was the Cold War. So this was World War IV, and we had to commit everything forever into an endless war on terrorism all around the globe. And Obama's not buying into that, even in the slightest. Not that he's done everything right. I think the drones is a bad policy and so on. But he's not going around invading countries left and right. And I don't think he wants to get involved in Syria. And that's driven these people, quite mad. And so, of course, they're going to be, making all kinds of noise about it. But unless there's some sign, which I don't see, that rhetoric on their part is beginning to resonate, with the American public, I think an Obama can ignore them politely in public, and probably privately behind the scenes he's laughing at them, because they have, very little, leverage at this point.
Well, they should all be in jail, frankly. I don't even know why anybody listens to them. But
Well, unfortunately, while I agree with you for the most part that they should be, punished for their crimes, they're all still out and about. And starting, with Dick Cheney and the rest. But, they are not in jail, but also not in power. I guess we can say that safely.
Well, Robert Dreyfus, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Dreyfus, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, Iran, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. Robert Dreyfus was profiled as a leading investigative journalist by the Columbia Journalism Review, won two awards from The Washington Monthly, and was awarded Project Censored's first prize for a story on the role of oil in the U.S. policy towards Iraq. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, and he has an article at The Nation, The First Good News for Syria. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Pakistan's elections coming up on Saturday. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Samir Dasani. In addition to having family ties in Pakistan, Samir has been researching and writing about military, religious, and cultural life in South Asia for the past 15 years. His articles include Power and Patronage, the Political Economy of Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Samir Dasani.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, the former cricket legend Imran Khan, who's the head of the new PTI party, who fell from a crane. He's expected to make a full recovery, but he's fractured 3 vertebrae and a rib, and he appeared on television from his hospital bed. With the election coming up on Saturday, how do you think that's going to play, Samir? Is it going to make him, give him the sympathy vote, or make him look weak?
I don't think it'll be worse for Imran Khan's party than it would have been without that. It may be slightly better. But in any case, you know, his party was always expected to come in a fairly distant third place, and I think that's probably still the most likely scenario. From what I can tell in looking at the polls, it looks like the Pakistan Muslim League, which has a couple of factions, but the faction led by Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, is expected to come in top. The second position seems to be, according to the polls, the Pakistan People's Party. And then third would be Imran Khan's Tehreek-e-Insaf Party.
So in terms of being a spoiler, what kind of effect would they have, and are they having?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, what Imran Khan has had is had this party for many years, for more than 15 years. But only recently, so I'm talking about 2011 and 2012, only in that period has the party sort of emerged as this big sort of mass force against corruption. Its center is really in urban areas. It has a lot of sympathy among sort of urban and young urban people. But what Imran Khan has been doing in the last, say, 6 months to 6 to 18 months, I think, year and a half, he's really been going around villages and spreading his message, which is largely an anti-corruption and anti-status quo message. So the question will be not really, you know, if this party will gain enough votes to be spoilers, but rather, you know, will this party be willing to enter into a coalition? Because it's unlikely that one or the other, the Muslim League or the Pakistan People's Party, would have a clear majority. So the question would be, you know, would this, they may be kingmakers, maybe the right way to put it. And would they be willing to enter into some kind of a coalition government with a party that they accuse of corruption, and they accuse both of the mainstream parties of corruption? So that's the question that will be interesting to see.
Well, of course, the tragedy of Pakistan's politics, and a lot of people now are celebrating the fact that this will be the first democratic transfer from an elected government to another elected government because of the so many military coups and military governments. But it seems that the Pakistani people have had this Hobson's choice for some time between military rule, military dictatorship, and civilian kleptocracies whose votes are based on a kind of feudal system that mm-hmm. both Sharif and the Pakistan People's Party under Bhutto represent. And Bhutto himself, of course, was often derisively referred to as the bag man. So there's no end to corruption in the civilian politics. And indeed, there is some questions whether Imran Khan himself may well be a front for the military. So walk us through that because, you know...
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no shortage of conspiracy theories in Pakistan. And I think that, you know, one says that and then one finds that some of these conspiracy theories do have some evidence. But I think in the case of Imran Khan, you know, we know a lot about the guy. We know what he was like as a cricket, you know, when he led the Pakistani cricket team. We know what his political platform has been like for the last 15 years. And I think it would be a mistake to see him as coming from the left or coming from sort of progressive forces. I think it's he's very center. I mean, his messaging has been very middle of the road, maybe center right, if anything, because he seems to have made alliances with some of the more religious-oriented parties and so on, although those aren't really formal alliances. This is just what people sort of intuit. But what happened was, you know, in the wake of sort of vast movements in South Asia, in Bangladesh, and especially in India, against corruption, that movement, and then you had the Arab Spring happening in the Muslim world, in North Africa and in the Middle East. I think what we saw in 2011, 2012 was that Imran Khan kind of filled that vacuum. There was this real need for a leader who could speak out and say, look, you know, this is a government that's responsive to the needs of elites, feudal landlords in Sindh, Punjabi industrialists, and the military, and of course the United States. So either it's elites within the country, or it's a completely different country that it's accountable to, that the government is accountable to. And Imran Khan played that role. He played it very well. Whether he is more pro-military or less pro-military than others, it's difficult to say. Other people have track records. Both the Muslim League and the PPP have their own track records, not particularly good track records, as you mentioned. I think if you go back to Zulfikar Ali Bhutto in the 1970s, he is the last leader with whom, for whom I can say the Pakistani public feels a lot of resonance. When they take his name, I'm referring now to Benazir Bhutto's father, of course. When they take his name, they sort of take it with some kind of reverence. This is someone who really tried to put in place policies that would be pro-Pakistan, pro-poor people, and so on. Those policies, as you mentioned, weren't actually allowed to flourish because right away in 1978 you had a military coup and Zia-ul-Haq came to power backed by the United States. Zia-ul-Haq and the United States were sort of the two forces that were responsible for turning Pakistan into what it is today, a sort of a feudal and hyper-religious backwater in many ways, with a nuclear-armed backwater, if you like. So, you know, there's this tragic history of military dictators, U.S.-backed military dictators, and then civilian governments that have always been had some level of corruption. But I don't think corruption is a real problem. I mean, I think the question is to what extent, you know, even corrupt governments can be responsive to, you know, local needs, local priorities, and so on. So if Asif Zardari, the former prime minister who used to be called Mr. 10%, if his only crime was sort of skimming off the top, I think many Pakistanis wouldn't see that as the most serious offense. I think the most serious offense is that Pakistan's development strategy, Pakistan's sort of anti-poverty strategy, has just never been put on track. And I think one reason that it's never been put on track is because leaders, whether civilian leaders or military leaders, have not been able or willing to question the role of sort of feudal structures of this massive landlord system, and now the role of the military. The military is itself the largest landlord in Pakistan. So until you're willing to attack those power structures, you're not really going to be able to end poverty.
And again, I'm speaking with Samir Dasani. In addition to having family ties in Pakistan, Samir has been researching and writing about military, religious, and cultural life in South Asia for the past 15 years. His articles include Power and Patronage, the Political Economy of Pakistan. So obviously, Imran Khan, is, as you pointed out, is not going to win this election, but he may be a future leader or at least a future force in Pakistan's politics. Will he, isn't he pretty much a representative of the elite? He may be against corruption, but he's certainly a part of the privileged class, and it's endemic, as you've pointed out. And until the wealthy in that country show some social responsibility and even pay taxes, which they don't do, and until you break up this feudal landlord system, and as you point out, the army, which the old joke is, Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country, those are very tall orders, are they not?
No, these are tall orders. I mean, no one would... would downplay those. And like I say, I mean, Imran Khan, although he does have an anti-corruption agenda, it's not clear to me that he has a sort of transformational agenda around transforming the nature of Pakistan's economy or around... The other thing to say is that, you know, if he was vocal about that kind of thing, if he was vocally challenging the power of the army or challenging the power of landlords in Sindh and Punjab, I think there are those probably among his advisors who would be saying, look, don't be too vocal about your political stances on some of these things because you need U.S. support, you need the support of landlords, you need the support of political elites to get anywhere. And then once you're there, if you want to have a political agenda, you can have it. So there's all this, and that's the other thing that people that he's probably hearing is, you know, you don't want to be assassinated for taking the wrong political positions. And in a place where, you know, Benazir Bhutto was assassinated about 5 years ago, and it's not exactly clear why or who even to this day. And just last week, we had a situation where the lawyer who was investigating, who was trying to find out who it was who actually actually detonated the bomb that killed Benazir Bhutto, that lawyer was killed. So the situation is very unstable, and people are careful about expressing what they think too publicly for fear of either losing power or just simply being killed.
Well, the Pakistan Taliban have been active blowing up political candidates and trying to assassinate them, particularly the Awami National Party. So that's the amazing part of what's happening in Pakistan is how the state seems to be under such flagrant attack. You had the whole Swat Valley invasion, etc. And where does the secular and religious divide stand now? You know, there's a lot of fear in the West that it'll become an Islamic country with nuclear bombs. But then you have the secular forces seem to be corrupt, and you can understand why poor people would be attracted to religion in the absence of any justice. So give me your analysis of where the secular vis-a-vis the religious forces stand today.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. You know, Pakistan's leader, first leader, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, was not a particularly religious person. In fact, you know, he himself had a long history in terms of being an anti-British freedom fighter in India. But so he, you know, he's someone who he was a Muslim, but he drank wine, he ate pork, these kind of things, right? And then you have the situation where because the country was founded based on religion, so it didn't have a perceived space for Hindus or for Sikhs, two things have happened. One is that the minority communities, because there are Sikhs, there are Hindus, there are Christians there, the minority communities are heavily persecuted, are heavily targeted. And secondly, there's been an increased radicalization. And actually, I misspoke in a way when I say that that comes from the beginning, from 1948, from Pakistan's independence. That actually doesn't come until the late 1970s. And so you have this alliance between the military dictator, Zia-ul-Haq, and the U.S. And the U.S. was putting a lot of money into the sort of Talibanization, is what we would call it today, but that's not the right word in that context, towards making Pakistan a much more religious fundamentalist country in the hope of stirring up all this religious fervor so that they'd go and kill, you know, Soviets in Afghanistan was the rhetoric in those days. So this is very much a monster that the CIA has created, and I think now they're kind of appalled at what they've created. Of course, what's happened in recent years, as U.S. funding has gone down, Saudi funding has gone up. And so we have that sort of, you know, the money dedicated to sort of radicalization and fundamentalist efforts in Pakistan, the money has not dried up. The money is very much there. Whereas if you're trying to open a school, if you're trying to, you know, if you're trying to work, for example, with minority communities, if you're trying to do some of the work that we try and do in our efforts in Pakistan, it's very, very difficult. It's hard to raise resources. It's hard to have access. Infrastructure needs are very great. It's hard to go to some of these places. But if you want guns, if you want weapons, they're very easy to find.
But what happened to the Kerry Lugar money? Because I know that that got demagogued a lot by the press there. We were talking about it being a kind of stalking horse for Blackwater and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Where does it stand now, the money? I mean, a lot of it hasn't been spent, has it?
No. I mean, Pakistan, I mean, U.S. aid to Pakistan is an interesting story. It's always, the problem has largely been absorption. The problem has largely been that the U.S. is willing to give money, but Pakistan isn't always ready to spend it. And then there's other questions. So Kerry Lugar may be a more transparent, you know, issue. But there are also things like the CIA's black budget. There are also things like the relationship between the U.S. and the ISI, the Pakistani Security Agency, and so on, which we just don't know. I mean, a lot of people suspect things. A lot of people, you know, wonder about how the ISI has become such a you know, one of the three or four most massive intelligence agencies on the planet. And it, you know, so we know that there's sort of U.S. money somewhere there, but it's hard to prove exactly what's going on. So look, the ties, the monetary ties between the U.S. and Pakistan are just very complicated, and they're very much there. That presence is huge.
Well, but they're contributing to a black economy, but the black economy exists, does it not? It's a Pakistani black economy. It involves the military, the ISI, drug trade, you name it, right?
Absolutely. No, I think at this point in history, we can say it's a Pakistani economy. But I think, you know, if we look from 1980, that black economy didn't really exist. And so I think we have to say, okay, what happened between, say, 1975, 1978, until, say, 2000, when that economy was maybe the majority of the economy. I think it's largely to do with the U.S. setting up the system of madrasas. It's largely to do with the U.S. funding its war against the Soviet Union. And you're right. In the last 10 years, it's very much taken on a sort of an independent existence. But even in the last 10 years, we have the case after 9/11 of the U.S. needing to push Pakistan and push General Musharraf in a direction that was opposed to the will of 99% of the Pakistani population. And the only way he could do that was with, you know, huge bribes. So even in the last decade, this has been a system that's been supported by the U.S.
and exacerbated by the Saudis, or continued, the worst part of it. They're essentially funding the Taliban and the madrasa system.
That's true. That's true. And for me, you know, because of the close links between, you know, U.S. and Saudi geopolitical interests, it's hard to know where to draw that line. And for many people in the
Muslim
world...
That's a huge dilemma and a question that I keep trying to find answers to. Are the U.S. just incredibly stupid? Are the Saudis so duplicitous that they can con us at every turn, which is what they're doing in Syria? You know, they're supporting the Al-Qaeda people there. You know, that is a huge question. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but...
No, I think you're asking exactly the right question because, you know... So Syria is an interesting example. I mean, I don't think the Saudis are doing whatever it is they're doing without the explicit or implicit blessing of the United States. So in the case of Syria, it's, you know, the Saudis are backing a proxy war with the blessing of the U.S. In the case of Pakistan, or even Bangladesh or the region in general, I think the Saudi presence, you know, for us who live there, it's toxic. But I think for the U.S., I think the U.S. sees this as one way to sort of increase its presence to some extent. I'm not actually sure that the U.S. has a long-term strategy, but right. I do see that there are ties between U.S. military strategies and some of this sort of funding of fundamentalist groups. And I can say not just Muslim fundamentalist groups, it's also the Hindu fundamentalist groups, which are also, you know, increasingly strong in India, which also seem to have some U.S. backing as well.
Well, it sure sounds counterintuitive and counterproductive to support the Taliban, these Taliban types, who are the most implacable enemy the U.S. has. And we're supposed to have this so-called war on terror going on, and they're enemy number one. So it is puzzling to figure out what these Machiavellian motives are here. But just in closing then, Samir Dosani, what is your sense then of, just back to this election on Saturday, what, there are 172 seats. What do you think, that Imran Khan will end up with, what, about 40?
Yeah, look, I won't make predictions in terms of seats or even in terms of percentages. But, I mean, it does seem likely that Imran Khan's party is definitely going to be in third place. I think we have, you know, a situation in Pakistan where, you know, the PPP is very strongly entrenched in certain regions, those regions being Sindh and Balochistan. And the Muslim League is strongly entrenched in other regions, namely Punjab. And so because of those sort of political machines, those are the two parties that are likely to come up with the most seats. Whether either of them will have enough to form a government seems unlikely. And so therefore, Imran Khan's Tehreek-e-Insaf party really becomes the key to this whole thing. If they're willing to go in coalition, whichever group they go into coalition with is likely to be the ruling party.
And they'll have some leverage. Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Samir Dosani.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Samir Dosani. In addition to having family ties in Pakistan, Samir has been researching and writing about military, religious, and cultural life in South Asia for the past 15 years. His articles include Power and Patronage, The Political Economy of Pakistan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm